Good evening. This is your host, Mr. Dark, bringing you a series of some of the most terrifying, strange, and true short horror stories of crimes, murders, abductions, and experiences. You're listening to the Dark Side Diaries podcast. May 4th Massacre, Kent State Shootings. The Vietnam War was one of the most polarizing events in U.S. history. Protests over the war began small, but gained national attention in 1965. As the war raged on and the U.S. invaded a neutral Cambodia, one peace rally event would turn into a violent and deadly protest. This would mark the first time that a student had been killed in an anti-war gathering in United States history. This is the story of the Kent State Massacre. Kent State University was one of the biggest college campuses that not only protested the war, but many other forms of societal issues they thought were injustices. From 1966 to 1970, the student body would protest during a homecoming parade, stage sit-ins, break into administrative buildings with a list of demands, and other staged events. By 1970, the tension was high. On Thursday, April 30th, 1970, President Nixon would launch the Cambodia incursion by United States combat forces. Cambodia was a neutral country, and Nixon believed North Vietnam was transporting troops and supplies through the neighboring Cambodia into South Vietnam. He hoped that bombing supply routes in Cambodia would weaken the United States enemies. This would lead to a May 1st protest on Kent State University campus. The students organized a demonstration to protest the invasion of Cambodia. But that evening, between drinking and anger over the invasion, the crowd would make its way toward the center of town, breaking some windows. Police would disperse the crowd at the corner of Main and Water Streets. The Kent City Mayor, Leroy Satrum, saw the crowd, heard murmurs of a radical plot, which caused him to declare a state of emergency. He reached out to the governor in Columbus for help as well, who sent a National Guard officer immediately. The local authorities closed the bars and hundreds of people were forced into the streets. Riot-geared police herded the crowd toward the campus with tear gas. And by 2:30 a.m., the town was quiet again. The next day, Saturday, May 2nd, students assisted with the cleanup downtown. Rumors of escalating activities were widespread, and threats to local businesses brought even more fear. Some of the rumors were plots to spike the local water supply with LSD and students building tunnels for the purpose of blowing up the town's businesses. University officials obtained an injunction or order prohibiting any damage to buildings on campus. The Office of Student Affairs distributed the notice of this injunction to try to curb any violence. A request to send more National Guard from city officials because of the lack of police force was granted, but they wouldn't arrive until 10 p.m., leaving a lot of time for mayhem to ensue. By 8 p.m., over 1,000 people surrounded the barracks, housing the Army Reserve Officer Training Corps on campus and set the building on fire. While trying to extinguish the fire, Kent firemen were struck by rocks and other objects. Firemen would leave after hoses were punctured and cut open. By midnight, the National Guard made numerous arrests, mostly curfew violations, and used tear gas to disperse the crowd, and the city and campus went quiet again. Tension was high, and by Sunday, May 3rd, Ohio Governor James Allen Rhodes called the student protesters un-American, referring to them as revolutionaries set on destroying higher education in Ohio. As National Guardsmen occupied a deceptively calm city and campus, some meetings produced a number of conflicting perceptions, resulting in misunderstandings among state, local, and university officials. Tempers would escalate again, and by the evening, a crowd gathered on the commons at the Victory Bell on campus and refused to leave. At 9 p.m., the Ohio Riot Act was read and tear gas was fired. The demonstrators gathered at the corner of East Main and Lincoln Streets, and the crowd grew angry as they were waiting to discuss with officials who never showed up. The crowd became angry, and at 11 p.m., the Riot Act was read again. Tear gas was used, and a number of people, both guardsmen and demonstrators, were injured in the chaos. This caused resentment among everyone. School and classes would resume on Monday, May 4th, and protesters were determined to hold a peace rally at noon, even if prohibited. The National Guard stayed to disperse any assembly. University officials attempted to ban the gathering, handing out 12,000 flyers stating the event was canceled. But it didn't work, and an estimated 2,000 people gathered on the university's commons near Taylor Hall. Ohio National Guard units on the campus grounds attempted to disperse the students, but it was met with chants, curses, and rocks thrown at the guardsmen. Shortly after noon, the National Guard fired tear gas at the protesters, but with the wind blowing, it had little effect. The guard moved forward with fixed bayonets, forcing protesters to retreat. Guardsmen were told to be locked and loaded and affixed with bayonets. Most carried M1 grenade rifles, 45 handguns, and a few carried shotguns with 7% birdshot and 00 buckshot munitions. Before they advanced, they were told to only fire into the air. Reaching the top of the hill by Taylor Hall, the National Guard moved the demonstrators even farther to a nearby practice field, where the guard realized they were fenced in on three sides and boxed in with supporters in front of them. Tear gas was traded again for more rocks and verbal abuse. After clearing some of the demonstrators, the guard was ordered to regroup and move up the hill past Taylor Hall. Some demonstrators followed behind the guard, some even as close as 20 yards. During their climb back to Blanket Hill, several guardsmen stopped and half-turned to keep their eyes on the students in the Prentice Hall parking lot as they were being hit with rocks. A sergeant named Myron Pryor turned around and began firing at the crowd of students with his 45 pistol. A total of 28 guardsmen then fired 67 shots in 13 seconds toward the parking lot. When the guard began firing, protesters ran and dropped to the ground. Some protesters thought the guard was firing blanks and only panicked after they noticed the bullets striking the ground around them. When the firing had stopped, 4 people lay dying and 9 wounded. The closest casualty was 20 yards and the farthest was almost 250 yards away. All 13 were students at Kent State University. Chrissy Hind, lead singer of the Pretenders and a student at Kent State University at the time, was an eyewitness that day. In her 2015 autobiography, she described what she saw. "Then I heard the ta-ta-ta-ta-ta sound. I thought it was fireworks. An eerie sound fell over the common. Quiet felt like gravity pulling us to the ground. Then a young man's voice, 'They fucking killed somebody.' Everything slowed down and the silence got heavier. The ROTC building, now nothing more than a few inches of charcoal, was surrounded by National Guardsmen. They were all on one knee and pointing their rifles at us. Then they fired. By the time I made my way to where I could see them, it was still unclear what was going on. The guardsmen themselves looked stunned. We looked at them and they looked at us. They were just kids, 19 years old like us, but in uniform, like our boys in Vietnam." Many guardsmen later testified that they fired because they were in fear of their lives, which was questioned due to the distance between them and the students killed or wounded. Disbelief, fear, and attempting to save lives gave way quickly to anger after the shooting happened that day. A group of around 300 demonstrators gathered on a slope nearby right after the shooting happened. Not wanting to move, Faculty Marshal Glenn Frank was able to convince them when he pleaded, "I don't care whether you never listened to anyone before in your lives. I'm begging you right now, if you don't disperse right now, they're going to move in, and it can only be a slaughter. Would you please listen to me? Jesus Christ, I don't want to be a part of this." Kidnapping of Bobby Greenlease. Robert Greenlease Sr. was a multimillionaire Cadillac dealer and auto entrepreneur. He was the first individual to franchise the Cadillac automobile west of the Mississippi River, where he expanded and marketed the Cadillac throughout the Midwest, West, North, and South, long before Cadillac was part of the General Motors Corporation. Robert, 65 years old at the time, and his wife Virginia would have a son, Robert Bobby Crossgrove Greenlease Jr., on February 3rd, 1947. Robert and Virginia were extremely devoted parents to Bobby and his older sister Virginia Sue. Robert had an older son from his first marriage named Paul Robert Greenlease, and Virginia would say he was a great older brother to her two children. The family being Roman Catholic would find the two kids in a Catholic school upbringing. With a happy and prosperous life, it would take a dark and sinister turn for them. Carl Hall, 34, and Bonnie Hetty, 41, would do the unthinkable. Paul attended school with Paul and swore to victimize his former classmate's wealthy family, and Hall and Hetty did just that. At 6 years old, Bobby attended the French Institute of Notre Dame de Sion Catholic Elementary School in the Kansas City, Missouri area. On September 28, 1953, Hetty would go to Bobby's school and convince a nun that she was his aunt, telling her that his mother had suffered a heart attack and was in St. Mary's Hospital. The plan was to get a $600,000 ransom from the family in exchange for Bobby's safe return. Hetty took Bobby away in a taxi. When another sister from the school rang to inquire about Miss Greenlease's conditions, she discovered the truth and her husband contacted the FBI. Paul and Hetty then took Bobby across the state line to Johnson County, Kansas, and never intended to carry out their end of the bargain. When another sister from the school rang to inquire about Miss Greenlease's conditions, Virginia discovered the truth and Robert contacted the FBI. Paul and Hetty then took Bobby across the state line to Johnson County, Kansas, and never intended to carry out their end of the bargain. On the drive, they talked with Bobby about his pets and even bought him ice cream. They ended up on a secluded farm in Kansas, where Hall shot Bobby at point-blank range, killing him. They took Bobby's body to St. Joseph and buried him in the backyard of Hetty's house. Hall and Hetty were still planning to collect the ransom. After nearly a week of 15 phone calls and more than a half dozen ransom notes, Greenlease, desperately trying to save his son, held off the police and the FBI and would pay them the money, all $600,000. At the time, it was the largest ransom ever paid in American history. Hall promised to send instructions on where he could pick up Bobby, but Hall and Hetty never delivered. Hall and Hetty didn't have a plan for after all this. They were both severe alcoholics and drove nearly 400 miles to St. Louis, where they rented an apartment. When Hetty passed out, Hall put $2,000 in her purse and left. Hall took a taxi and the cab driver reported his suspicious activity to the St. Louis Police Department. On October 6, Hall was arrested and the FBI was notified. They were able to tie him quickly to the kidnapping as they were following it since the beginning. Hall gave up Hetty and she was arrested the same night. The FBI would recover Bobby's body as well. Only half of the $600,000 ransom was recovered and remained a subject of wide speculation. But after a few theories and searches, two of the arresting police officers, Lieutenant Louis Ira Shoulders and Patrolman Elmer Dolan, told the grand jury that the $300,000 they turned over was the full amount. It turns out this statement was false. In fact, Shoulders had taken half of the $600,000 ransom that Hall had on him the time of the arrest. Both officers were convicted of perjury and served prison time. Hall and Hetty were tried, convicted, and after just over an hour of deliberation by the jury, sentenced to death for the crime. Only 11 weeks and 4 days passed between the time of the crime and the executions. On December 18, 1953, Hall and Hetty were executed together in Missouri's gas chamber. Less than 3 months after Bobby's kidnapping, Hetty is one of only four women to have ever been executed by federal authorities. This concludes our episode of the Dark Side Diaries. Please remember to follow, like, share, and subscribe for future episodes.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.